This is Kate Swanell for the NJA. Today our special guest is Professor Kathy Griffiths from the National Institute of Mental Health Research in Canberra. Professor Griffiths is co-author of a perspective in our 2nd of March issue entitled Where to Mental Health Reform in Australia? Is Anyone Listening to Our Independent Auditors? Thanks for your time.
Thanks for asking me.
No problem. Do we need another review of the mental health system?
No, we absolutely don't need another review of the mental health system. What we've got to do is to learn from what we've already found out and implement the solutions. We don't need to keep asking the question. We need to find the solutions to it now.
Is this the problem with the democratic system? The new government comes in and wants to reinvent the wheel but doesn't trust what the last government found out?
I'm not sure if that's the explanation, but certainly there has been a history of many reviews over the last 30 years. And if you read them, the findings are very similar across those reviews, which seems to suggest that there's a need to actually take action.
Maybe it's more a case of mental health being a difficult subject to tackle and there being a reluctance to give it a good hard go.
It is certainly the case that it's not easy at all, but at the same time, There have been conclusions and recommendations from these reviews which simply haven't been taken up. So I don't think that we should say, well, we have a difficult problem, so, you know, it's just too difficult, let's leave it. Yeah. I think we have to try and really seriously tackle this system and try and not just perpetuate a sort of dysfunctional system, but try and change that system to make it work for people.
So what are the big hurdles that have to be overcome?
We did a systematic review of independent investigations of mental illness, or at least the mental health services system in Australia. And so, these were people like auditor generals, public advocates, and so forth. And what we found across these different reviews and across jurisdictions and across actually the spectrum of the mental health care system was that there are a number of problems. And one of those problems was a lack of access to services for people, whether those services related to the prevention of mental illness or whether they related to inpatient services, community health services. There was a lack of access. The second problem that we found was that there was a lack of coordination or at least cooperation across sectors. And that wasn't only within the health sector, it was also outside of the health sector. So obviously for people with a mental illness, things like accommodation are extremely important, but you need people to be able to talk right across the system with each other to make a system function properly. A third factor that emerged from these this systematic review of reports was human rights problems. So, you know, human rights issues were being raised right back when Burdekin did his report in 1993 and before that, of course. And that certainly emerged as a problem. The other two problems were gaps in training. So, again, across the sector, whether it were police or whether it was crisis care workers, there was a need for training. And finally, there was a problem with the documentation of what was actually happening to people in the system. So quite poor surveillance information, by surveillance I mean collection of data as to what was actually happening right across the system and right across the different aspects of the care system. So certainly I can elaborate on those, but they're the five issues that emerged.
The data monitoring issue you bring up, is that a state-federal divide? Is there too much fragmentation nationally?
I think the data monitoring problem, it's not necessarily that state-Commonwealth divide, although, you know, that may be an issue. It wasn't something that was raised by these auditors because typically the reports were actually in a specific jurisdiction rather than across the Australian landscape. But the sort of thing that emerged was, for example, in a New South Wales report, the auditor wasn't able to determine how big the workforce was, the mental health workforce was in the community mental health sector in New South Wales, because the data wasn't there to to enable them to do that.
That would seem to be a fairly basic thing, really, doesn't it?
How can you plan and how can you know what's going on if you're unable to answer that question? And of course, a big issue in the mental health services sector has been since deinstitutionalisation, where people who had been in psychiatric institutions were then discharged, if you like, to the community. That was a good idea, but you needed community supports to support that change. And the funding that had been devoted to inpatient services, that funding also in the community sector. And that is a problem that people often highlight in the mental health services sector, that we don't have that funding going into community mental health that we need in order to support everybody within it. Right. But if you don't know how many people you've got among you, you know, that's a problem, obviously.
Let's talk a little bit about the human rights issues, because is it just a simple lack of resources?
Well, I can't see it as a lack of resources. I think that the issues that were raised were quite fundamental.
Yeah.
Things like the transfer of people who were a no threat to anybody else to hospital in a police van when instead of an ambulance, when the protocols would suggest that they should go in an ambulance. Things like crisis teams asking for people who are intoxicated to be retained in a police cell when that's against the, you know, the Charter of Human Rights. And things like the violation of national privacy standards in not providing a private consultation space. They're basic human rights, and I don't think they require funding. So I think it has to be some sort of training issue where we need to ensure that everybody at every level understands what, you know, what's required in the system, and I guess some sort of accountability, monitoring those things as well.
We've had so many reviews.
Have
there been an equal number of consultations about what the solutions might be and what the next step is?
There isn't any accountability mechanisms built in to ensure that those reviews are implemented or those recommendations are implemented. So one of the suggestions we made in the paper in the Medical Journal of Australia was that there should be some mechanism by which the information can be fed into the planning of mental health services nationally and locally. And one of the suggestions we made was that the findings of these reviews should be ensured that they reach the Australian Minister's Advisory Council, you know, so that they're not just sitting there on a shelf languishing.
If you were queen for the day, what would be the first thing you'd do?
That's a very interesting question.
Apart from lying on a couch having somebody feed you grapes, what would you do about the mental health system?
For a start, I'd start doing something. At the moment, I don't know if you're aware, but all the mental health services that are funded under the Commonwealth system are basically nobody knows if they're going to be refunded in July on July the 1st. So at the moment, we don't have any surety for patients or consumers that they've got services in for these particular programs past July the 1st. Yeah. And similarly, neither do the staff that are employed in these services know that they've got a job. So you have the potential of losing people. And there's been a survey by Mental Health Australia which has shown just that. People are leaving because there's no certainty around that. So I'd start actually doing something. That would be one of the things. Again, the Mental Health Council, of which we're a member, has suggested that we need a 10-year mental health plan. We definitely need accountability built in. You know, we can't just have policies that never get implemented and indeed never even get investigated as to whether or not, you know, that they were successful. So essentially, we've got a lot of the answers already. It's a matter of actually implementing, of changing the system. We need to take innovative approaches. So we need, in addition to providing services, we do need to have prevention put in place. And that is a sort of population level approach, but can also be targeted to people who are at risk. And we can do that. We have the technology to do that using the internet in a scalable fashion. And certainly that's one of the areas that I work in. And prevention, if you're trying to implement prevention programs, I think the internet is one way to do that. I think a second thing that we need to do is to implement destigmatization programs. And while that may seem to be a bit lateral to the question you asked, I think it's really important, because I think stigma happens not only in the minds of people, but it can happen structurally as well within systems. Systems can stigmatise.
Yes.
And the people that actually run those systems can be stigmatising or discriminatory. And an example of that, if I might say, was the report which reported that people who had a primary diagnosis of a mental illness were not eligible to receive supported accommodation under the disability program.
Yes.
in New South Wales. Now that's discrimination. I mean, basically the response to that report by the department was, well, if we provided people with a mental illness with support, look at all the other people with a disability who'd miss out. But that's not the point. I mean, the point is equity. So I think we have to, everybody from the Prime Minister down has to not stigmatise mental illness, and so the decision making will reflect an equitable process.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of things that I would do. I mean, I just did a systematic review for a journal, an international journal, on stigma reduction programs. I reviewed all the programs, and we do know what works, and we should be implementing what works, but also trying to develop, through research, even better destigmatization programs. And I agree that we should be targeting doctors. I think we should be targeting medical students.
Yes.
And they can carry that through with them. And it's important not only for the way that they think about the people that come through their doors, but as you say, about their own mental health. Strangely enough, we probably attribute greater stigma to people around us than is actually in the community. I've done some research around that as well.
Yeah.
So people's perceptions that the stigma in the community is greater. I mean, it's definitely there, but it may be that if we are aware that people perhaps aren't as stigmatising as we think that they all are, we might be more prepared to go and get help. And, because help seeking is another big issue that isn't raised in the report that we wrote, but which, given that only a third of people with a mental illness actually seek professional help, we're looking here mainly at people who are help seeking and can't get help, but there's a huge percentage of people who don't get professional help at all.
Yeah.
So, and we need to get them to help. Now, there's a problem if we've got limited resources and limited access already. How do you cater to that?
Yeah.
And although I'm a little biased, I think that, again, to some extent we can use internet programming, appropriately, not to replace face-to-face services, but to be used in appropriate circumstances.
You were talking about the uncertainty in the sector at the moment. Is that a symptom of the budget woes that the government's had? I mean, everything seems to be up in the air still, and we've got another budget coming up in whatever it is, 6 weeks. Is that the problem, or is this an uncertainty that's been around longer than that?
Oh, look, I think in general there's been an uncertainty around non-government organisation funding, for example, in this sector and possibly other sectors. Instead of being able to plan ahead, there's always this last minute, at the end of the financial or the 3-year period, is this program going to be renewed? But I don't actually see that is a budget issue per se. I see, because we should be having longer term planning than that. So I see it as a planning issue.
Can you be more specific about the access issues that are happening in the sector at the moment?
Yes, certainly. For example, a big problem was not being seen unless they were in crisis. And that's a particular problem because as I have a little quote which I think is particularly apt here to describe this problem. A young person in Western Australia said, telling someone who's got an eating disorder that they have not yet lost enough weight to be seen in an eating disorder clinic is BAD bad. And I think that sums it up. You know, we shouldn't be just focusing on crisis. And I think another factor that struck me was the what's called demand management strategies where you, for example, in this case, general practitioners were given vouchers. And when they ran out of the vouchers, they could no longer refer people on to this particular service. So they just had a number of vouchers. It wasn't based on need. It was based on essentially time and the number of vouchers the GP had. And that's not an appropriate way of doing things. So similarly, I think we shouldn't be working on diagnosis as a way of determining whether somebody is able to access the service. It's about how something is affecting the person, what the need is. Yeah. So really, those were the sorts of issues that surround providing services based on need rather than on some other factor.
Thanks so much for your time, Professor Griffiths.
It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.